not your normal theme song, because today is not a normal day. It's birthday time! And time for Too Wretched for Radio with the birthday boy. Hello, Phil! How are you feeling today?
I am feeling very old.
How old are we today, Phil?
Well, let's just say I'm old enough that I have to apply for Medicare. I turned 65 today. I'm an official geriatric.
That does not sound good, I have to confess.
Trust me, it's not.
To be labeled geriatric, it sounds you are one banana peel away from slipping, breaking a hip, getting pneumonia, and it's all over but the shooting.
That is exactly right. I feel it, too.
And welcome back from vacation. What's the big idea, taking some days of rest?
It was fun. Went to New York City and just turned off the, for the most part, turned off the social media and had fun with my wife and my granddaughter.
Ah, it's very, very, very sweet. Now, do you think when Paul talked about wintering in, begins with an A, Asmus or something like that, when he wintered, he talked about wintering someplace. Do you think that he was maybe just kind of taking a little vacation? Is that possible?
He might have been. I mean, you know, Jesus himself set that example. He said to the disciples, come apart and rest a while. He was frequently trying to get away from public ministry in order to have times of rest. It was never very successful for him because wherever he went, the multitudes followed. But, yeah, I think he set the pattern, and it's pretty clear. I mean, that's actually built into the Sabbath law, isn't it? That
right.
We should take time and rest from our labors.
Yep. So vacation, okay. And everybody gets to decide with their discretionary time, discretionary income, how to do that. And we should not be in judgment with one another. Although I think a week was too long. Okay, I'm not judging. I'm just saying a week was too long. Let's get to it, shall we? There's a lot that is going on. Not just in the Southern Baptist Convention, but in the Gospel Coalition. It seems, well, pretty much everywhere in Christendom right now. In fact, even in politics, Tucker Carlson, Phil, you just retweeted a Tucker Carlson tweet. He seemed kind of perplexed. What's up with racism? Why everything seems to be racist. Everything you talk about politics, it turns into racism. You talk about economics, it turns into racism. So, Phil, I'm going to ask you, what's up with all the talk about racism?
Well, I've asked that same question, and I'm not sure. It just seems to be the topic du jour. And no matter what other topic you might raise, somebody will find a way to bring it back to the issue of racism. And you would think, wouldn't you, that racism is at an all-time high. It's a worse problem than it's ever been. I think there's a sense in which racial conflict, or at least resentment, is a worse problem than it's ever been. But it seems to me that, I mean, I don't know any actual white supremacists. I know there are some out there, but it's like even the KKK. It's a shadow of what it once was. It's as deplorable as it ever was, but it certainly doesn't seem to me that it ought to be, and especially among evangelicals, that it ought to be given the level of priority that so many evangelical leaders suddenly want to give that subject.
Yeah, well, we're gonna dive into that just a little bit deeper. But before we get to that, I still want to try to pursue why this is fomenting the way that it is in social, in secular circles as well as Christian circles. You know, sometimes movements, they're creeping, they're growing, and then after a season, it tends to be a J curve.
Yeah.
It's like making progress, and boom, to the moon it goes.
Yeah.
I just wonder if so much of the politics of our day has played into it, the education of our day.
Yeah, no question about it. And social media, too, has made personal discourse interaction between people a lot more hateful than it used to be, because people will say things on social media that they would never say to your face.
Right.
I was thinking about that just this morning as I was reading the Twitter feed, and you know, everybody's upset about Trump and racism and those subjects. And somebody made the point that in their face-to-face interactions with friends and people in their social circles, nobody ever talks about politics like that. But the same people who you might, you know, have a friendly chat over coffee with, get them on social media and somebody raises the issue of some political topic, and suddenly everybody's angry and spewing venom at one another. It's uncanny.
Yeah, it seems we should be able to do better. Yeah, it's pretty gnarly out there. Now let's dive in to what is the message behind the current conversation. Let's focus specifically, if you don't mind, on the Gospel Coalition. If you recall, the Gospel Coalition, they presented MLK 50 with the Southern Baptist Convention, celebrating the life and legacy, hopefully not the theology and the lifestyle, of Martin Luther King. And there was a lot of talk about being woke. Start right there, Phil. What does it mean to be woke?
You know, I use that word almost as a... it's a shorthand for someone who has imbibed the left-leaning political perspective that's currently popular today. To be woke is to have a perspective that, you know, racism is the most important, most urgent topic right now, as if this is a problem that we've never faced and have never seriously addressed, and things haven't gotten any better since the Jim Crow era. Wokeness seems to involve a perspective like that, and that's why it's troubling, because I think it fails to recognize the fact that really I don't think there's probably in the history of America been a greater consensus than there is today that racism is an evil. It is evil. It's horribly evil. But is it as widespread as it was even in my childhood? I think not.
Well, that's the question, and I think that's part of what wokeness is trying to capture. The idea is that there is systemic racism, but you, Phil, because you're a white, geriatric, Christian, European male, you don't even get it. You don't understand.
Right.
You're a part of the system. It's built in to oppress minorities and women. So once you get that and you see that the whole system is rigged, you don't have to have racist thoughts, but you are being racist because you're participating in the system. So that's a part of wokeness too. So here's my question, Phil. Have you read anybody, and I know you've been doing some of the, I've been tracking you online and following your tweets and what have you and having conversations about this. Has anybody built the case somehow factually that our current culture, the system is indeed rigged to oppress specifically black minorities and women? Has anybody been able to demonstrate that?
Well, not in a way that satisfies me. Normally, that point is made simply by pointing at very broad statistics that, you know, would suggest that the average household income of a black family is lower than that of a white family, without even considering what other factors other than racism might play into those sorts of figures. So I don't see it as proof that there's systemic effort to sort
okay,
of...
I want to break this down because I think, Phil, this is kind of crucial because this doesn't really need to be said, but if you and I discovered that there was a systemic racism, it's built into the system where it is just, it is oppressing people unjustly, we would jump to the forefront of that movement. That's not in question here. But I just haven't seen anybody who's been able to state this is because of that somehow,
right,
capitalism, freedoms, the way that our system is set up as a representative republic, that it was somehow built specifically for the advantage of white wealthy people.
Yeah.
So without that case being made, you're right, we have to say, well, okay, what is the reason for lower income disparity?
Right. And you know, just over the course of, say, the past 40 years or so, as long as I've been a voting adult, it seems to me that virtually all of the new policies that have been put in place by our government dealing with the issue, there were racial issues and economic issues and, in you know, all of that. All of the policies that have been instituted for 40 years have been to the advantage of oppressed people. you know, the people who would be disenfranchised and on the margins of society, immigrants and, you know, low-income people, urban communities and all of that. Government programs are set up to help them. And that's good. I have no problem with that. But to then look at all the progress, or what seems to me to be progress, that has been made since the Jim Crow era and say, you know, things are worse than ever, it takes a pretty jaded look at, you know, the current state of our country.
All right. Let me see if I can share an example so that we can want to reason through this and figure this out with a willingness to understand. Somebody recently sent me an email. It was very polite. It wasn't snarky. It wasn't like the internet. It was a Christian letter from a Christian woman who is black. And she said that she was saying, there just is this systematic racism that's built into the system. And my response was, I want to understand that. So could you please share with me three examples of how you have seen built into the fabric of our culture systemic racism? And one of her responses was VA loans, that there was a program set up for vets coming out of the war so that they could afford a home and get established because of the sacrifice they made. Well, there was a disparity between the number of black people, and percentage-wise, and white people in VA loans. And the reason that she cited was there were real estate companies, realtors, not the government, but realtors in some of these neighborhoods. They determined that if 15% of the inhabitants of the homes in a development were black, if more than 15% were black, it would depreciate the property values. Therefore, they did not give as many loans to black people as they did to white people. I'll chime in on that, Phil, but do you believe that that is a valid demonstration of systemic racism built into the system?
Well, first, I would want to know the actual facts about that. That's an anecdotal tale. Are those statements factual? And is it a fact that property in communities with more than 15% black people actually do depreciate more rapidly? I don't know. I think those are matters that are determined by actuarial tables more than, you know, prejudice or.
All right, but let's just say that that's what went down.
Yeah.
Would that be a fair example that to state, see, the whole thing is rigged?
You know, I wouldn't go so far as to say, see, the whole thing is rigged. I would say if everything she says about that is accurate, then I think, yes, there is a problem that needs to be addressed. I don't assume that somebody has rigged this against a particular race or whatever. But if it works to the disadvantage of that race, then I think we need to ask what is the reason for this and how can it be corrected? There are a number of factors that I can envision that would contribute to that. If it's, you know, maybe the culture in those neighborhoods needs to be addressed and upgraded so that depreciation doesn't happen. I don't know. And like I said, those aren't simple matters that you can look at an anecdotal tale like that and say, yeah, that's proof of systemic racism. The overwhelming evidence seems to me to be the opposite, that the government since the 1960s and the Civil Rights Act has done everything it possibly can to and is doing. It's not to say that everything that needs to be done has been done, but the direction has been to level the playing field for everyone, and to be saying, you know, that hasn't happened, just seems to me to take an awfully cynical look at life and our culture.
Well, I think we would agree that let's just say over the course of the last 40 years, 1,000 laws have been passed. Is it possible that a law, two laws, five laws, I don't know, X number of laws maybe had somebody behind it who was racist and perhaps even had people in mind that they wanted to disadvantage. Well, let's just say that's a possibility.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
At what?
Because theoretically it is possible, but is that
sure?
Does that even sound reasonable to you or to me? It doesn't to me, because I know that most people in public life and in politics are determined to stamp out the vestiges of discrimination that, you know, we're in place in the Jim Crow era. And systematic, if you want to talk about what government has been systematically doing, it's trying to move the needle in the right direction. And so I don't understand the suddenly very high level of resentment that's bubbling up in public media, but even more troubling to me within the evangelical community.
Right.
Suddenly the evangelical community has jumped on this bandwagon, and we're being told that this is a more pressing problem than... In fact, I tweeted about this yesterday, and it amazed me the number of social justice warriors that have come out of the woodwork to scold me for holding this view, that suddenly racism is somehow, you know, a more pressing problem, a more urgent difficulty for the church to solve than bad teaching and false doctrine and apostate churches, which is what I think evangelical leaders ought to be really more focused on. Not to say that injustices like racism don't matter to us, but are they really the most pressing priority for us? Is this the thing that threatens the health, the spiritual health of the evangelical movement today? I don't think so.
Well, when you consider the amount of false teaching that is in the evangelical movement,
right,
or at least subpar teaching, yikes. That I think we could demonstrate is systemic. There's little debating that.
Well, I mean, you do demonstrate it every day. That's one of the running themes and always has been on Wretched Radio, because there's so much of it out there. You just play the average sermon from the typical megachurch, and it's absolutely appalling. And to look at that and say here's a false doctrine or doctrine-free teaching, a church that really doesn't care about the gospel or the truth, and that's not as big a problem to you as than
Stephen Furtick,
some earthly form of...
Sorry, a little something stuck in my throat right there. All right.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about a contentious word right now that people who are concerned about this current conversation, so folks like us, there's a group of people who are calling folks in the Gospel Coalition who appear to be trying to move forward the racial dialogue, calling them neo-Marxist or social Marxists. First of all, what is a social Marxist? And second of all, is that the best way to describe the people in, say, the Gospel Coalition who are promoting the things that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if anyone in leadership in the Gospel Coalition is self-consciously Marxist and trying to subtly promote Marxist ideas in a conscious and deliberate way. But I think there's a legitimate criticism to be made. This is one of the tactics of Marxists, that they want to divide society into warring factions, different races, different economic groups. You know, and it used to be the proletariat against the privileged classes. Now it's race against race, but it's the same thing, trying to foment tensions and hostilities within society, because that then gives them a political advantage and the manipulative tools to make whatever issue it is they want to promote the top thing on the agenda. And you can see that happening. So in a sense, yes, I think it's a legitimate concern to point out that these are Marxist tactics. If you go a step further than that, though, and say, well, I think this guy who's in leadership at the Gospel Coalition must be a closet, you know, socialist or Marxist or communist or whatever, that gets into sort of the conspiracy theory type thinking that I eschew.
Yeah, I Gesundheit, I agree with that totally. That I don't think they're like, okay, we just got back from the Karl Marx convention. This is what we're... it just so happens that some of the tactics and some of the ideology happens to be similar.
Yeah.
With Marx, it was proletariat bourgeoisie. Today, the tactic is white, black.
Right.
The wealthy, the poor. And the idea is to obliterate the oppressive class.
I think it is reasonable to trace a line of influence that goes directly back to people who are self-conscious Marxists promoting, you know, Marxist ideologies and all that. And mainly they're influential voices in the academic world who over the past three or four decades have begun so much to dominate, you know, college level and postgraduate level studies, that they've influenced people through education. And
we were asking, where did this come from? I think that's part of the answer right there.
Yes,
this
the academic
is, this
world.
Has been being taught for decades on university campuses.
Right. And you've got a lot of people in leadership right now. I've said this over and over again. One of the great blights on the evangelical movement is the widespread notion that what we desperately need, if we're ever going to influence the world, is academic respect. We need to have the secular academy's approval, or we're never going to have influence. That was the whole mentality behind neo-evangelicalism back in the beginning of the Billy Graham era, and Christianity Today and Fuller Seminary and all the men who were interconnected with these organizations. You listen to them, read what they wrote. They were obsessed with the idea of academic credibility, academic respect from, you know, secular schools and liberal schools. And it influenced all those institutions for evil, really.
There's a biblical word for that. And I know it because I heard a sermon from some guy, Phil somebody or another, talking about the subject of worldliness.
Right.
That's a worldly attitude.
It's really the essence of worldliness, desiring the respect of people who are influential in the world. And Scripture couldn't be more clear. I mean, the Apostle Paul denounces that mentality in the first three chapters of 1 Corinthians. He's writing to this church that is fraught with all kinds of problems, and he spends the first three chapters on this long diatribe about the folly of human wisdom you know, where he says to them, look, you know, look at yourselves. It's not many of you who are wise and well-educated and wealthy and powerful who've been called, but God calls people from the dregs of society just so that all the glory goes to him. Mm-hmm. This is the way God has always worked. And for Christian leaders to think that the one thing we desperately need is academic respect, we need to impress the secular minds who run, you know, the intellectuals. There's just no quicker path to apostasy in the church than that. And that's what I fear has led to a lot of this.
Now, see, I could inject something there about old earth creationism doing the exact same thing, but I'm not going to do that right now because that's not the topic.
Exactly. But if you're trying to impress a group of people who are, you know, hardcore Marxists, you're going to absorb Marxist influences and parrot those things. And that's
right.
What I think has happened.
Now, there's several more things that I want to talk about, and we're going to have to do it next time. I want to talk about reparations. There are Christians calling now for reparations. The subject that I also think is very big in understanding this is corporate guilt. Want to dive into those. Kevin DeYoung just weighed in with, I think, at least a forward-moving article to start opening up the Bible to see, can an entire nation be guilty of a sin, even if individuals didn't participate in it? Those are very big things. But here's what I wanted to close with two things, Phil. I think that you would join me in stating, everybody, let's kind of cool our jets on this deal, because these conversations, they take time, and there things need to happen, and responses need to be formulated, and arguments need to be sharpened. Let's let some of this play out a bit, and as we do, want to speak truth, no doubt about it, but to do it lovingly. Don't you think at this point that we need a call for just a kinder dialogue on the subject?
Yeah, no question about it. And we all need to realize that, and then I'm not calling people to get off of social media. I'm on social media myself, and I think there are certain things for which it's good to have that. But an issue like this is not going to be solved by a debate that takes place through Twitter entries. You know, even though Twitter doubled their character count last year, you still don't have enough room to really formulate a thoughtful and thorough argument that's gonna actually win people over on something like this. You might make a point here and there, but if that's your main or only way of arguing these issues, then maybe you ought to get off social media.
Well, and also just an encouragement, because I know some people are anxious about this. Like, well, you know, when is this thing going to be resolved? Well, let's remember, heresies in the old days, sometimes it would take centuries. A little slower back then. So, you know, we're probably dealing with months here.
Right. Yeah. Also, in fairness to people with whom I would disagree, the social justice warriors, I can see why they would be irritated by someone saying, well, when are we going to resolve this? Slavery went on for several generations. I don't think you can just, you know, suddenly expect everybody to give up their concerns about racism just because we say
right.
It's over.
Yeah, right.
So that, I'm not pleading for people necessarily to just, you know, give it up or whatever, but to sort of back off the harsh rhetoric and the sort of urgent sounding calls for complete reorganization of our society and realize that, you know, these things do take time to resolve. And let's be patient with one another.
And I would also say to folks who are seeing this and they're wondering, okay, why isn't anybody saying anything? Why isn't anybody doing anything? I think it's just fair to say, just give it a little time, because I think that it just, these things don't happen like, just like it's a ping pong game where it just goes back and forth. Sometimes weeks and months go by because things are being worked on or positions are being formulated, responses are being drafted, etc. I think that we'll get more clarity as time goes. So I don't think we need to be anxious about this. But Phil, the second thing that I wanted to share before we go.
Okay.
Happy birthday, old man.
Phil's Osophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?